You are listening to Particular Pilgrims, stories from Reformed Baptist history with commentary. I'm your host, Ron Miller, pastor of Covenant Baptist Church of Clarksville, Tennessee, and a longtime student and collector of Particular Baptist history. We are on the Man of God Network, brought to you by Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary. Having looked at the life of Isaiah Burt and some of his friends, let's return to the Plymouth Baptist Church and Pastor Philip Gibbs. Now that Burt was pastoring the nearby Baptist Church in Plymouth Dock, Gibbs needed an assistant. The church was alerted to William Winterbotham of London, and in January of 1790, he supplied the pulpit. His preaching was edifying, and the people invited him to become assistant to their pastor, which he readily accepted. Before we proceed with the story of his pastoral and political life, here's what we know about his background and conversion. William was born in Aldgate, London, on December 15, 1763, into a staunch Anglican family. As the sixth of 15 children, he was early sent to live with his maternal grandparents in Cheltenham. There, his grandfather taught William a love of liberty, which stuck with him throughout life. After a little bit of schooling, he was apprenticed to a silversmith. Upon finishing his apprenticeship, he worked for himself as a buckle maker, but his dissolute lifestyle impacted his health, and he had to return to his parents' home. William had never been to a dissenting chapel or heard a nonconformist preacher. So when his brother decided to go hear an open-air preacher from Africa, he went along to, quote, hear the devils preach. His brother was soundly converted that day, and his changed life impacted William. So in the late summer of 1786, he began to attend worship with his brother at an independent chapel. There, under the preaching of a Reverend Radford, he was, quote, brought as a poor sinner to the cross of Christ, hoping and believing. His life changed, but this only brought censure from his parents. Soon he desired to tell others of the mercy he had received, and he began to preach. In 1789, he became convinced that infant baptism was unscriptural, and so he gave himself to be immersed upon profession of faith by a Baptist deacon in the River Lee at Old Ford. Shortly after this, he was contacted by Plymouth and moved there. He preached regularly for several years, doing good to the congregation and also to himself, for he was diligently studying the scriptures. He records that he felt privileged to have, quote, an aged and experienced divine who oversaw him, referring, of course, to Pastor Gibbs. William normally consulted him on the sermons before he preached them. As an aside, we learn from the trial transcriptions that I'll describe in a moment that William normally preached about 45 minutes and that his sermons were written out. You may have noticed that he didn't have anything like formal training for the ministry. Time for focused study was to come in a very unexpected and difficult way. On November 5, 1792, which was a Monday evening, William delivered a weeknight sermon entitled, quote, The Commemoration of National Deliverance. This was the anniversary of both the 1688 Glorious Revolution, which brought religious toleration to England, and the foiling of the Gunpowder Plot of 1605, which was an attempt to simultaneously assassinate King James I and Parliament. All across the country, on this day set aside by the government, clergymen held special services to commemorate these national deliverances. Winterbotham used the opportunity to remind his audience both of the blessings of being Britons and of the unfinished work of implementing liberty. Now, what the government expected on this day was a wholehearted display of full loyalty. And while Winterbotham did this to a degree, he also criticized some things. For example, he said that if a present king subverted the Constitution, the people had a right to, quote, hurl the despot from the throne, just as those Britons did years ago on the day they were now celebrating. He argued for greater representation and liberty for dissenters. Later, he would extend this to Catholics, Jews, and Muslims. He argued that, quote, all government originates with the people, end quote, and he urged various economic and parliamentary reforms. This sermon provoked a strong reaction from some, and it was reported to the government. Many false claims were made about it. It clearly was the talk of Plymouth Town. So Winterbotham followed with another sermon, this one on Sunday, November 18, 1792, to answer the falsehoods. But at this time, the government was very sensitive to keep the French Revolution, then in full swing, from entering England. Any lack of support from public men was considered suspect. The result was that in the next year, Winterbotham was served with two indictments for the two sermons. The basic charge, and there were many, was sedition, meaning that he had incited people to rebel against the English state. We have the contents of the sermons, and comparing the indictments with his words shows that this was a thoroughly unjust political prosecution. It appears he was charged in order to frighten others into silence, using false witnesses and a stacked jury to guarantee a conviction. The judge was remarkably fair, but after the two trials, the juries found him guilty of both indictments. The sentence was 4 years in prison, a £200 fine, which is many years' employment, and a £900 security upon release to guarantee his good behavior for 5 years. So at the end of 1793, he was placed first into Clerkenwell Jail, where the poor conditions harmed his health. His legal team was able to get him transferred to what is called the state side of Newgate Prison in London. Now, I've introduced you to Newgate in the past, but the state side was a part of it where, for large sums of money, a man might receive better treatment. He could have his own cell or apartment, visitors, and a number of additional privileges. Now, there was a problem, of course. Winterbotham had no such resources. But as the object of government persecution, many like-minded people came to his aid. Thousands of pounds were given to his support. And so when he exited prison, all of his bills were paid, both legal and the fines, and he even had a little bit of money to start life over again. He was able to regularly meet with men of similar political views and have access to books for studying. During his years in prison, he published his two sermons with a commentary and a defense of his political views. He produced a 3-volume view of the United States that lauded the new nation as a great example of liberty. There are a number of first editions of this for sale, and if you have many, many thousands of pounds, you could purchase your own set. He also penned a 2-volume history of the Chinese Empire. All of this was the result of the liberal gifts of his friends, some of whom were Baptists, but his political friends were mainly Unitarians, Quakers, or others. And so his imprisonment became the place of his education, both from books and by testing. He was finally released from Newgate on November 26, 1797. And that same day, married Mary Brend of Plymouth. She had been a hearer of his sermons and a witness at both of his trials. They had 7 children together, and William returned to Plymouth and continued to assist until Pastor Gibbs' death. He continued as the church's pastor until 1804. It was then that he accepted an invitation to become the pastor of Shortwood Baptist Church, the same one we recently studied for a number of episodes. While there, he received an anonymous gift of £1,000, a huge amount of money at the time, apparently from someone who felt guilty about his prosecution. He never learned who the donor was, but his own thought was that it was one of the jurors. Winterbotham's long service at Shortwood ended with his death in March of 1829. William was an unusual man. His gifts for self-education were significant, but he was influenced by the age of reason, perhaps more than he knew. For example, the scriptures tell us that governments are set up by God, and they don't derive their ultimate legitimacy from the people. Another was that he too easily assumed that the French Revolution was of the same character as the American Revolution. Now, many of his views about civic rights and freedom of religion are classic Baptist positions. But his open espousal of specific political views from the pulpit put him in the sights of the government. As his grandson would later say, quote, "The sermon was undoubtedly a political one, and having regard to the prevailing excitement on the subject of the French Revolution, the preaching of it was certainly imprudent." Living at the same time and in similar circumstances, Andrew Fullers identified, quote, "an eager and deep interest in political disputes as a key cause of spiritual backsliding." Winterbotham avoided this by God's grace and lived a vibrant Christian life, useful to his church in the following years. But knowing where to draw the lines in preaching between the scriptures, public ethics, and politics has always been a tricky matter. Thank you for listening today. This is Ron the Baptist, wishing you grace and peace.